Welcome back to the ARHT Pre-Hospital Critical Care Curriculum. Today's lecture is under Module 3, Shock, and it's Chapter 2B, focusing on damage control resuscitation.
Guys, this is an awesome podcast. We're excited about it. I'm excited about it. Stefan's not here, but he'd be excited about it as well. We've got an amazing panel of guests, so sit back and enjoy.
So we're lucky enough this evening to be joined by a panel of experts in trauma and resuscitation. Just like to take a minute and get each of you to introduce yourselves.
I'm Ian Civil. I'm a vascular surgeon and director of trauma services at Auckland City Hospital.
Whoa. I think we need to just explain exactly who Professor Ian Civil is to people that don't know him, for people listening to this perhaps from the Northern Hemisphere. He's an ex-president of the International Association for the Surgery of Trauma and Intensive Care. He's a founder and ex-president of the Australasian Trauma Society. He's an ex-president of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. He's on the editorial board of a heap of publications. He's served in the Gulf, and there's probably a whole host of things I've missed off this list as well. So he's a real expert. He's also heavily involved in St John, which are the pre-hospital providers, or the main pre-hospital providers in New Zealand. So we'd just like to say thanks very much for Ian joining us on this podcast this evening.
Good evening. My name is Chris Denny. I work as an emergency physician at the City Hospital and also as the medical director for Auckland HIMSS.
I'm Mark Fredrickson. I'm an emergency physician working at Auckland City Hospital. Originally trained in South Africa and in Australia and New Zealand, and been working in New Zealand now this time around for 7 years, and I have close links with the trauma service, and one of my main interests is major trauma.
So the first topic that we're going to start with this evening, gentlemen, is damage control resuscitation, and we're going to start with you, Ian, if that's okay. I was wondering if you can describe to us what damage control resuscitation means to you.
Well, the whole concept of damage control is a fascinating one, which has developed in the course of my career as a trainee and junior fellow. The word wasn't ever mentioned. And then over the course of the 90s, damage control became a surgical paradigm used in all sorts of surgery, but particularly abdominal surgery, to a lesser degree orthopedic surgery, to describe a situation where you were trying to make sure that the treatment wasn't worse than the disease that you were trying to treat. So you were trying to limit your intervention to the minimum required to limit the damage and allow you to recoup and, if you like, control damage, as in the Navy paradigm, and let the patient recover a little. Now, this concept, obviously, which applies in all areas, has now been used to describe the resuscitation scenario. And again, looking back on my career, I can see how we used to damage people incredibly with our resuscitation, without knowing it, thinking we were doing the right thing, of course. But a particular patient that comes to mind in this setting is coming from the Dome Valley by road, an hour north of Auckland, and coming down with a road crash, significant abdominal trauma. The patient came into the emergency department not looking great, I'd have to say, pale but conscious, low blood pressure, nothing measurable, 90, and obviously anemic. And so we resuscitated that patient with the non-damage control paradigm of the day, which was crystalloid and then more crystalloid and then a little bit of blood and then a lot more crystalloid. And in the course of that, a relatively short period of time, certainly less than 90 minutes, that patient became more and more distressed, more and more hypoxic, was unable to breathe, and clearly was resuscitated to death. Now that, if you like, is the opposite paradigm to damage control, where we're trying to give the patient the absolute minimum to maintain their physiology while getting the patient in a position to treat definitively the underlying cause of their problem. So in terms of the exact types of damage control resuscitation, that's possibly a whole different discussion, which others may wish to comment on, but the underlying principle with damage control resuscitation is to try and give the patient the minimum amount of appropriate resuscitation components to maintain their physiology and their blood parameters in a position where their life is maintained, and we can find out what the underlying problem is and treat it.
Tony, you had something you wanted to say?
My name's Tony Smith. I'm sorry, I had to leave the room and take a call from the coroner. I'm medical director for St John, and I'm an intensive care medicine specialist at Auckland City Hospital. Well, I was just musing about a statement that I've heard Kareem Brohi make on several occasions, and that is that damage control resuscitation is not a treatment. It's a necessary evil in a particular group of patients as part of getting them to the procedure which is required to stop the bleeding. And I think sometimes that's a very good way of thinking of it.
So with regards to damage control resuscitation, how does it apply to the pre-hospital setting? Tony, could you give us some insight on that?
I think listening to other people talk on this topic and reading about it, damage control resuscitation can mean different things to different people. For me, damage control resuscitation means three things. One is to absolutely do everything you can to stop the bleeding, and that is the absolute priority. And as part of that, if there's uncontrolled bleeding, at the same time doing everything you can to get them to a place that can stop the bleeding. So as an example, if there's major bleeding from a periphery, you apply pressure and or a tourniquet, but if there's major bleeding in the abdomen, you need to get them to an operating theatre. The second is to minimise the amount of fluid given to the minimum amount required to keep the patient alive until you stop the bleeding or get them to a place that can stop the bleeding. And in particular, to minimise the amount of crystalloid which is given and to maximise the amount of fibrinogen-containing products, assuming you have access to that. And then the third aspect of it, that as I understand it, is to treat and or limit the coagulopathy which is associated with trauma. And, of course, the last two aspects are interrelated. And I guess just finishing off on that third, because the specific question was with regards to the pre-hospital environment, currently the only potential... So currently the options that are available to us in terms of either treating and or limiting the coagulopathy associated with trauma are limited, but the things which are potentially available are tranexamic acid, noting that there continues to be quite a lot of controversy, and perhaps we could talk about that separately, but also fibrinogen concentrates, which may well be, I think, looking into the future, available in a pre-hospital setting.
So, Tony, you mentioned something there, not to put the words in your mouth, but you said to resuscitate the patient to the least amount necessary. And so, Mark, I was wondering if you would be able to comment regarding endpoints for your resuscitation.
We're talking in the emergency department setting. Yes. Predominantly. I don't have much pre-hospital experience. I think it's a little tricky question given that there's not a lot of science actually available with exact numbers because individuals are different. My general approach to these patients, if they're not intubated and ventilated for other reasons, if the patient is mentating and talking to me, I don't really care what the blood pressure is at that stage. They're perfusing their brain, so that's enough. I'm not going to be trying to rocket it up. There are some thoughts that a systolic of 70 is adequate to perfuse the coronaries, which is probably a good idea to keep the coronaries perfused. But yet again, that's very individual because some patients may be chronically hypertensive, and with autoregulation, everything shifts further up north, so they may require further blood pressure. So I don't think it's an absolute number that you can use, and I think a patient that's talking to you, communicating to you, not trying to jump off the bed and thrash is probably a good starting point. What do you do with a patient who's intubated and ventilated? If you're in the pre-hospital setting, I think get yourself as fast as you can to somewhere where you can do some definitive treatment. In the emergency department, I think in those settings, in blunt trauma, it may be a little bit difficult to identify where the exact source of the bleeding is. But over the years, we've become better and better at getting a better guesstimate of where it is with the advent of fast scanning in the emergency department, so we can focus our tests in a more timely fashion than we used to. So there's not a huge rush to crank that blood pressure all the way to the roof if you're in a definitive area. I think I'm generally happy with a blood pressure, if you're looking for absolute numbers, somewhere in the vicinity of 72 to 90 millimetres of mercury from a systolic point of view, as long as you're planning to do some form of definitive treatment. If you're somewhere where you can't do any definitive treatment or aren't planning to anyway, then it's a whole different discussion. So I don't think there's an easy answer to what an absolute number. I don't know if the panel has any better numbers.
Well, no, I was going to support your comments about managing the patient and trying not to concentrate too much on the numbers, although clearly in some environments you need a ballpark to start from. And I was just reminded of a paper that was presented at the American Association of the Surgery of Trauma last year, where the title was, "Is 110 the New 90?" And it was commenting on the fact that for older patients who are like, you know, the ones who might well be hypertensive, when you use an arbitrary number like 90 and say that's a good number to be at, or 70 or any other number, in fact, the patient mix may in fact make that the wrong number. And for the elderly patients in this particular study with a blood pressure less than 110, I forget, it was patients over 70 or something like that, behaved as badly as younger patients who had blood pressures under 90. And so an arbitrary number, when you don't know much about the patient, their comorbidity, what drugs they're on, etc., is probably a bad thing. But the things that you mentioned, like was the patient mentating, what were they doing, is probably a better measure. Tony might have some comments about pre-hospital specific numbers.
From a pre-hospital perspective, we try to divide our trauma patients into three groups, understanding that division is sometimes somewhat arbitrary, based on what we think is the most important injury, or more specifically, the injury likely to be associated with the most mortality and the most morbidity. And if that's traumatic brain injury, we do target a number, and the number's 120 systolic. And that's because if you have raised intracranial pressure, typically our severe traumatic brain injury patients will have a intracranial pressure, and when they first arrive, if you're able to measure it, about 30. And so that means in order to achieve a cerebral perfusion pressure of around 60, you need a mean arterial pressure of 90. To get a mean arterial pressure of 90, you need a systolic of 120. So now that's one of the few places in medicine where I do become, not focused because it's only one part, but the number becomes important to me. And you know, when we've got our patients in the intensive care unit and there's an intracranial pressure monitor in place, and you see mean arterial pressure fall, we will frequently then see our ICP rise through the vasodilatation that occurs in response to a falling CPP. So then the second group of patients we loosely call hypovolemic shock, and that's a middle ground for people who, you know, don't clearly have massively uncontrolled bleeding, and there we don't teach a number. We teach them to take a holistic approach and look at the patient, feel their peripheral perfusion, what is their heart rate, what is their blood pressure, what is their pulse pressure, because that's, for me, an important sign rather than just their blood pressure. But importantly, what is the trend of that over time? What is the trajectory of the patient? And if they're clearly hypovolemic, taking into account all of those signs, we will give them volume. We won't try and volume load them to normovolemia, but we will volume load them to prevent severe hypovolemia. The last group is the group we title uncontrolled bleeding, and here we're talking about massively uncontrolled bleeding from the peripheries, leaking abdominal aortic aneurysm we put into this group. The group of patients who have, for example, postpartum hemorrhage goes into this group, and here it's very much utilising the principles we've previously talked about with damage control resuscitation. So although it doesn't neatly give you a plan for each patient, we think that's a kind of reasonable approach to take your patients and divide them into one of those three groups and then apply those principles of resuscitation to that patient. But it's very rare that I think you can say this number is the right number for everybody. Well, in fact, you can't. You can't say that this number is the right number for everybody.
One thing I just add is, as a team leader, and we've talked about, we're taking a standard approach and we're applying a slightly different paradigm. So with damage control, or as Tony was just mentioning, with permissive hypotension, the room needs to know about it. So I think here's a really important point where, as a team leader, you need to make sure there is that shared mental model, because it's really tough. People will fixate on the airway, but the circulation sub-team will equally fix on pouring as much fluid and then some as they can. And I think if we aren't clear on a target, I think there's the risk that people will sort of go back to their default. So I just offer that caveat.
So, Chris, I'm going to hand the mic back to you with another question. This one wasn't included on the sheet, but it just cropped to mind. It was one of our listeners, Rob Gemmel, specifically emailed and asked me the question. And he wanted to know, in a traumatized victim who's bleeding, who's hypotense, with a GCS of somewhere between 12 and 14, so they're not unconscious, but they're in and out, and you're transporting them, what do you feel the role for RSI, for intubation in the pre-hospital setting is? Is it something that we should be taking that extra time to potentially do, or should we be flying and managing it en route, or is it something that we need to sort of to forget about and just get the patient to the emergency department?
It's going to lead with a lame, it depends. In my mind, the transport interval is important. I think what the immediate threat to life is important, where you're traveling. So, you know, if you're up first class with all the room in the world versus, you know, stuffed in the back of a VW, like a Beetle, I think it's going to be, in part, whether that GCS is something that is, they're still ventilating and their oxygenation's all right and the intubation would be a nice to have. Or I guess to me, if they are multiply injured, but you've got some distance to travel and you're taking a risk that during that transport, your ability to intervene is going to be severely compromised, again, usually by the constraints of space of your transport platform, then I think you have to have a conversation about whether you can get that done. But the important part, and I think traditionally we've always said, stay and play with, depending on what continent you're from, some disdain, or load and go, and again, let petrol be your tool of choice. I think this idea of playing en route is a really important concept. And many of the leading services will actually travel a good distance while they're doing their kit dump, setting up, pre-oxygenating, running their checklist. When it's actually time to perform the procedure, pausing, pulling over to the side of the road, and on you go. Now, in a helicopter, that's obviously not the same approach if you're offshore, but I think it is something where this, again, is talking to the team, because something that would be easy to do in the emergency department and might make sense may or may not, depending on the darkness, the rain, the temperature, etc. But imagine there's different views here. Over to Stefan.
Thanks, Chris. I just wanted to take it one step further. And Tony and I had a discussion a couple of days ago when I wanted to know, when would you not RSI? At what point is a patient too unwell? I wanted to know that I would not attempt to RSI this patient. When is the physiology at such a state that I should not attempt it? And I liked your answer. Would you mind sharing that with us, if you could remember the quote you actually told me?
As I recall, I think I said something like, when I thought the right ventricle was so empty that further positive pressure in the chest would make it nearly empty. In other words, when the trajectory of the patient was in such a downhill spiral. And we do see some patients like this where if at the time you add positive pressure to the chest and increase intrathoracic pressure, you further reduce venous return to the right-hand side of the heart. And I think in resus and ED, we get away with it because we're often activating the massive transfusion protocol at the same time. So at or about the same time that the positive pressure is going in the chest, we're also adding a quick 4, sometimes 6 units of blood. And we get away with it. I think where it's hard to get away with it is where you can't do those things simultaneously. And so for me, and I have been a couple of occasions where I have deliberately delayed RSI, despite the patient being quite unconscious, deeply unconscious, where the cause of the unconsciousness or the coma is hypovolemic shock, and where the trajectory is such that I think the right ventricle is close to being empty, and I've deliberately delayed adding positive pressure until we've arrived in the ED and the massive transfusion protocol is being activated. I think that's you know a judgment you have to make on each patient, and it depends upon the trajectory and it depends upon where you are and how much further you've got to go to get to that. Coming back right back to that principle, if the patient's dying from hypovolemic shock, the first principle is to stop the bleeding. And you know whatever we do shouldn't be delaying the time to that intervention. It's all about time to intervention, time to definitive intervention.
I think a lot of the issues sometimes arise that it's still taught A, B, C, and we haven't really in civilian medicine moved on to that controlling the hemorrhage first up before the airway is pretty important the majority of the time. Because in these hypovolemic shock patients, a piece of plastic into the trachea is generally not what's going to save the patient's life. If you think that is the case, that they have some other injury that needs that airway protected immediately, then I think you don't really have a choice. You need to do it. But yeah, if you can hold the airway open and you have suction, etc., available, running the risk of doing an RSI and putting the plastic in an uncontrolled situation is not going to save the patient, may potentially do more harm to the patient. So I think you need to take each individual patient. If you think the piece of plastic is going to save the patient, do it. If it's just another part of your management of the patient, it certainly can be delayed until you can do it more safely and controlled.
I think that's a really helpful, interesting discussion that we've just had there. I'd like to move on to thinking about what we are going to do if we're going to do anything. So thinking about your third group of patients that you were talking about, Tony, where you are going to, or second and third group of patients, where you are going to give some treatment to them to try and help with their perfusion, and acknowledging that we're saying there's lots of ways that we try and measure perfusion, not just the blood pressure. That's the coroner probably for Tony.
He's back.
We know there's quite a few different interventions that we can do. You can give blood, you can give crystalloid fluid, you can use inotropic support to try and improve perfusion. And Ian, I was wondering if I could get your take on those different modalities and which ones you think are effective or not effective in the traumatised patient.
Well, clearly, both pre-hospital and in hospital, you are, to some degree, what you can do is determined by what you've got available. And so if you have made the decision that the patient's level of consciousness and perfusion is so bad that they need something in a damage control environment, and the only something you've got is crystalloid, then that's appropriate fluid to give. If you have other fluids, and say if you had uncross-matched blood as an option, well then that's likely to be a better option, because we are trying to maintain hemoglobin, we're trying to only give a minimum amount of, well, whatever volume is required at a minimum level to sustain a level of blood pressure which will maintain the patient's viability. So, I mean, I think those are the two common options that one may have to consider, and crystalloid is really only the first option if it's the only option, and blood is probably a better option. Now, in hospital environment, you may, even in pre-hospital, you may have some other fluids available, some plasma-related, some colloids or whatever, and in that context, they may have a role as well, but it, probably not again as a first line.
The other thing that I mentioned was inotropic support. Do you have any...
The only situation where I think you can make a strong case for inotropic support, and I'm absolutely prepared to defer to greater knowledge on this, is clearly in the patients who have spinal cord injury and whose hypotension is primary vasodilatory. I mean, that's a classic situation where you will probably never get the blood pressure up despite giving 3 or 4 litres of crystalloid, but you'll certainly give them a lot of compartment syndromes if you do that. So that if you recognise that, that would be one particular situation where I think inotropes come at the almost at the top of the list, even before, well, at the same stage as some fluid. But other circumstances, I defer to other experience.
No, I think Ian's right. I think the tools that We have with HIMSS that to us are bringing some of the emergency department out into the streets, include ultrasound, and Mark's mentioned this, but I think the ability to interrogate, looking for, if you will, the etiology of the shock is invaluable. And I think that can be done again whilst in transport. So I don't think that the ultrasound has to delay your scene interval. I think the use of tranexamic acid, and in our case of whole blood, is informed largely by the military, but I think with the civilian studies, and we've just reviewed that in the last podcast, again, to Ian's point, it's a small volume that's carried, but I think for the interval of transport that we have, and when we agree, is I think we have that we're not trying to maintain a normal blood pressure. What we're doing is we're trying to identify in a subset those who can actually tolerate quite a low perfusion target, and those who, through traumatic brain injury or others, may require an augmentation. But I think, as Ian's mentioned, in the multiply injured patient, you may have more than one cause of shock, and a hemorrhage may be a driver, a key driver, but if there's a neurogenic component, I think that would be a classic spot, or I suppose anaphylaxis, where you'd want to think about adding an inotrope.
You know, I think taking up from Chris's point there, you know, not all shock in the trauma patient is caused by hypovolemia. So don't forget one, medical causes and other, as Chris mentioned, the anaphylaxis that may have caused the driver to veer off the road. We recently had a patient who had a similar stroke, had a primary medical event, crashed the car, and ended up in the hospital, three quarters dead, but not quite there. And it took a while to actually determine that his hypotension, and that actually wasn't at all trauma related, and it was a primary medical event that related. So, you know, don't forget the medical causes of hypertension that may well require some inotropic intervention from the vasodilatory point of view. And the other things of hypertension, not forgetting tension pneumothoraces, amongst other things that can be easily relieved, and you don't have an issue with giving volume. And I think we've certainly, with fluid management in these patients, we've done a couple of circles backwards and forwards over the years. But one thing that's certainly clear, stuff that even in my relatively short career, is pouring in bucket loads of crystalloid just does not do any good for anyone. And as the coroner's pretty busy with Tony, keeps them in business. And there's nothing worse than iatrogenic causes of injury to patients who already had a massive insult. So I think in those patients, if you're going, well, am I going to give inotrope? Am I going to give fluid? If I'm going to give fluid, I'm going to give blood products. If I don't have blood products, what am I going to give? And the ED, it's easy because we have everything. You know, we can give as we choose. And I think replace what you're losing. You know, you're not losing bucket loads of crystalloid fluid. You're losing bucket loads of platelets, plasmas, coagulation profiles. So early activation of the massive transfusion protocol is paramount to these patients' well-being and potential for survival. So don't be afraid to hit the button. If your hospital or area doesn't have a massive transfusion protocol, it is highly recommended that you get one. So there is some recipe to follow. I'm sure Chris would love to talk about TEG and its involvement in ED, but I think that's still evolving. And
we don't have TEG on the helicopter either, I don't think. I don't think RHT have funded it quite yet. But
I thought you had all the toys, bells and whistles.
Spinning thing.
Rotem. Rotem.
Just stick the vial up into the rotor blades.
So, Mark, you mentioned there about the patient you had before who ended up actually having a medical cause for their unwellness. I guess open to the whole of the panel, are there tips or tricks that you have to help you differentiate between a traumatic cause of hypotension, shock, arrest in a patient versus a medical cause when you see patients that arrive in the ED or when you see patients in their pre-hospital setting? I might fire this over to you first, Ian.
Two things, I think. The first is where the mechanism doesn't match the injuries that you see, and the classic one is the low-velocity car crash or the fall from a low height where the patient's much worse than you would expect for them to be. And the second is known history. These days we get a lot of assistance from our electronic medical records in hospital. There may be things about the patient, pills they're carrying, medical alerts or whatever, that tell you a possible reason for a medical cause to their injury, and the past presentation to the hospital may also outline possible causes. So those would be the two things I think of.
In agreement with Ian, I think what I'd add, one is the detectives are often going to be the paramedics and the first responders who bring the patient to hospital or to whom we intercept. And so I think just having a structured handover allows everybody to hear it. I think often it's been my experience that there's some kernel of some clue which is going to help you with the diagnosis that often is kept with a junior member of the team and isn't shared. So I think, again, as a leader, just making sure that that information is fully shared. And I think the other part I was going to mention is when you're going along and things aren't improving. I think there's this, you know, sometimes you just want to hit things a little bit harder, but I think if there's not the expected response to your therapies, that's when I will often pause and look for whether there's something else going on. You know, could be, you know, adrenal suppression. It could be something much simpler, but I think it's that failure to respond to therapy.
I think it's a very difficult situation. And as Ian and Chris have said, there is no exact tool to say that this is definitely traumatic, this is definitely not traumatic, it's just a cause. Yeah, I always refer to the trauma trap, in the sense that you assume everything is trauma related, and we all know what assumption is. And I think, yeah, you just have to use all the people who you have available to you. I find it from an ED perspective, the thing that really can bugger a resuscitation up is if you haven't listened to what the pre-hospital guys have actually said. You've stood there as a team leader and you've heard blah, 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 not actually taken in the specifics. So to reiterate what Chris said, listen to the pre-hospital guys. You know, a lot of the time they need to move on to other jobs, you know, at a quicker pace. But yeah, sometimes stop or question them again on what the accident looked like. You know, do they have any other information? And at Auckland, we have a whiteboard from a communication point of view, you know, plugged up on the board to get the pre-hospital information written down. So that's also a good tip to, if things aren't going well, you can refer back to that if your pre-hospital crew have gone to get, you know, to get more information.
So the last thing we'd like to discuss before we move on to traumatic cardiac arrest is the idea of the chain of survival, and has been aptly named here in Auckland, the Code Crimson. Mark, we're wondering if you could comment on the implementation of this.
Well, thanks for the hand grenade. To start off with, it's not implemented yet. We do it on a in all patients that we see. So the idea of a Code Crimson is to smooth the pathway to early definitive care in patients. You know, trying to reduce the human factor to the equation. So what I mean by that is the current general scenario that happens is patient comes in acutely shocked. Everyone knows that the patient needs to go somewhere else for definitive care. So what happens? Somebody is delegated to pick up the telephone and probably spend the next 10 minutes or so trying to get hold of the necessary decision makers to be able to perform that, being that, you know, the patient is either going to go into theatre, interventional radiology, you require a surgeon, anaesthetist, you require a blood bank, you require plain radiology sometimes as well. So the idea of the Code Crimson is a one-stop phone call or power page, which may well be the way we end up having to go, that the system works 24/7 and it doesn't rely on individuals to unfortunately make mistakes or to be given pushback. So the idea would be, you know, the massively unstable patient, Code Crimson called Code Crimson basically because crimson sounds like blood, doesn't it? And Code Red in our hospital means something else. So we can't use that. Would be that you could even task a clerk to make the call as long as you've got a dedicated list that goes out and all the players who are involved at the other end of the call know what their roles are within the system. And the call gets put out, and those people who are the necessary decision makers are available early to make the decision. It just smooths the patient's care from scene, pre-hospital, through the ED, and ultimately to the definitive point of care. It's not an easy thing to do. We're trying to make a lot of change, things that have never been done in a single way. It may change some people's approaches to the, because you're making a decision on very little information on the majority of time. We wouldn't go as far as the red blanket scenario that's run out of Brisbane, where they basically go straight from pre-hospital to theatre and an ED physician starts the anaesthetic while waiting for the anaesthetic team to come. I don't think we're at that stage yet, but there's a lot of buy-in from people for it. It's just a matter of making change within a system is sometimes not an easy thing, and it does take time.
So in all the excitement of discussing Code Crimson, Mark Fredrickson spilled a beer and the room degenerated, and an important question was lost regarding the trigger criteria used to initiate pre-hospital whole blood. So we'll pick it up again with Chris Denny answering a question regarding the ABC score.
So the question that's asked is, what's the trigger? How does one decide when to activate a Code Crimson? And we've looked around the world. I'm not sure that we have the answer. What is, I think, becoming clear to us is this is not in Auckland, so population 1.5 million, a daily occurrence. And so one of our challenges is we have hospitals which are operating, you know, with austerity and fiscal constraint, who need to achieve meaningful throughput. And so how do you keep those efficiencies and yet for the patient that arrives infrequently still be able to mount an appropriately aggressive response? And so the trigger tool, and we've mentioned this in the previous podcast that we've set upon, is one that, if you will, prognosticates for the likelihood of a massive transfusion protocol being required. So we've used this ABC score in part because it's objective, at least in terms of measurement, but secondly because all of the variables are easy to acquire in the out-of-hospital setting. So it's a heart rate, a blood pressure, the mechanism of injury, and then whether there's free fluid seen on point-of-care ultrasound. But I think the important concept, and Mark's just explained, is one of a relay race, or if you will, a chain of survival, and where cardiology has done so well from calling for help through to bystander CPR, timely defibrillation, right into sort of cath lab and post-resuscitation care. I think in trauma, for these patients, any one leg of the relay run poorly is going to have, you know, tremendous implications. So I think what we're trying to do is work to strengthen all of those individual links in the chain.
Can I ask a sort of nuts and bolts question of this Code Crimson? If I'm working on the helicopter tomorrow with Stefan, what does it actually mean for me as a pre-hospital provider when it does start to occur? Hearing what you say that it's not actually implemented yet, does it change anything that we're doing in the pre-hospital setting?
Yeah, so just to clarify, as Mark said, this is aspirational for us. I mean, we're working hard with our hospital to make a go. But the answer is no. I think the answer is to be having the situational awareness to anticipate, so that's to look ahead and to realize that whilst you're in the middle of this maelstrom, we're trying to make it easy, if you will, hassle-free for the pre-hospital provider. So if you can use a code word, in this case, Code Crimson, and that will cascade a whole series of necessary chains, you can imagine that's better than instead of doing all the things you might be doing on your way to hospital saying, Chris, would you mind calling the trauma surgeon and asking them to call the anesthetic coordinator, and actually while you're doing that, could you get the by the time I finish talking, we'll be to you. So I think we're trying to really simplify matters so you can focus on providing patient care.
I'll just say, don't ask for Code Crimson because you'll get silence at the end of the RT.
No, I think it'd be great. You should ask for Code Crimson and see what happens.
Well, a couple of weeks back, there was the very scenario that there was an evening with multiply injured patients who arrived, and speaking to one of my colleagues who was running it, she basically described what she did in the process of getting this patient to theatre, and she pretty much described the Code Crimson principle, but it took her 10 minutes to do. Whereas if we had a Code Crimson code that she could put out, it would be done in less than 30 seconds, and she can focus her skills on the actual patient care itself. We spend a lot of time within medicine doing a lot of administrative stuff that
yes, maybe patient beneficial, but it could be done by anyone. And if we can get a system where we spend less time doing administrative stuff and more stuff time doing clinical and patient care stuff, it can only be good for the patients.
That's great, and I'd just like to reiterate, you heard it here first, Ian Civil's happy for us to request tokenisms from now on.
So this concludes the lecture on damage control resuscitation.
I think you'll agree it was exciting, and if you thought this was exciting, wait until we get to Module 3, 2C, which is coming up next. Flick forward, listen to that. It's really exciting.
Signing off for the educational team.
I'm Chris Duncan.
And I'm Andrew. Take care.